If I can talk a little bit about jealousy. Yes. Yes. I'm very unhappy to talk about jealousy. That's the key element. When you look at what we call jealousy, then, you know, in the Dharma, there's a whole, we collect a whole group of, there's ambition in there, there's rivalry, there's envy and jealousy, you know. All of that, this competitive attitude, all of that is the same area. And basically, you already made the connection. Basically, it's the corresponding emotion to pride. Yeah, because both, they live from comparing ourselves with others. And as long as we are on the proud side, then we think we kind of have a compensating activity for our lack of self-esteem and so on. Okay, that's me, yeah, stronger. And on the jealousy side, we feel there is a lack. I'm not as good, I'm worse, I don't have as much. You know, there is all these feelings of lacking something. Both pride and jealousy, they are connected in ignorance and the lack of awareness in the center. Yeah, it's like both of them, they are a deep expression of not being in contact with just how perfect our life could be, our mind is, and not being in contact with the equality of all phenomena. Yeah, of actually that there are no qualities to attach to as being mine. So what is jealousy? Actually, that area is, you could say, it's the feeling a little bit like hungry ghosts, yeah? Hungry spirits, feeling dissatisfied, not enough. The happiness of others is painful for me. Yeah, the joy of others, I don't really want to see it because it creates so much pain and it touches my own needs so strongly. And there is a fear of never having enough, of not being loved enough. And so it's very painful. It's a painful emotion, jealousy. And in the Dharma context, we don't only use it for jealousy with, you know, with partners or some. This is not a big issue. It is a general attitude of not rejoicing, of not being able to rejoice in the happiness of others because of always wanting something more, lacking, feeling the lack of something. Yeah, so that's... And it shows in two different ways. There is the jealousy, which becomes an ambition, and it's like you put your sleeves up and you go for it. Yeah, it's like, okay, competition. Yeah, it's a form of rivalry, jealousy. It's like getting the energy of dissatisfaction forward. And then there is a jealousy which says, oh, there is an easier way. I pull everyone else down. So I make critical remarks about this. He is not good in that. She is not good in that. And you know about that one and this one. And so it's a jealousy which is more the lazy attitude. It's like criticizing everybody else. And then there is the obsessive activity jealousy part, which is like busyness, yeah, like what our world is made out of. That, yeah, is constantly trying to improve, never satisfied, the results are never good, next year they have to be better, and so on, you know, always. And this is actually a deep poison mental poison, which creates an incredible restlessness. And it is the klesha that is being completely dissolved by that all-perfecting awareness. Huh? That last one with the wind, you know, that I was explaining. That's when that awareness of just how perfect this present moment is, just how perfect our mind is, then this dissatisfaction leaves. And then one can really rejoice. Then one feels that everything is there, and one wishes everybody else to feel that sense of completion or joy, fulfillment. Yeah, it's then easy to feel that. Okay, so let's go for the next question, please, in the corner there. Yes. Special kids, children, and there are so many special children. I hardly see a non-special one. So you are thinking in which way? Ah, like in direction of autism. Often they come to me when they have already become adults. Yeah. So I've been guiding, accompanying quite a few autistic adults, and of course there were children before, yes. And you know, I don't want to give you a doctor's speech on autism. My personal appreciation is that they have an increased sensitivity. Yes, they are very, very sensitive, and some of the autism can be understood as a protection, for that heightened sensitivity. Also, I find often a very intelligent being behind. Yeah, I find a high, actually also they are often said not to be socially, so you know, they are socially withdrawn often, but they have a very high social intelligence. And just a little remark which might maybe confirm what you already feel is, when someone who is put into the category of autistic behavior or autistic child, when that child meets an authentic person, not trying to manipulate the child, then usually this child, and later on also the adult, will gradually open and will begin to trust. And that's really non-manipulation is very, very important. Respect also for the privacy, so non-intrusive, and completely sincere. I think those people who have come to me with their autistic problems, or whose parents also brought them to me, and actually they have a heightened sense for what is fake, yeah, what is not true. And we need to really be as true ourselves, not pretending anything. I think these are a few words, and you can ask more to get out more, but I'm in constant contact with one person who was highly autistic. I've been in two or three cases, the first person that they ever talked to in their life, and so on. So I know a bit from direct contact, but I don't know what to say now for this general question. So if you want to be a little bit more specific, I'm okay with that. You just said your son doesn't talk. Yes, so there is a language beyond speech which they speak, and we need to feel our way into the sign language and the non-verbal language. Sometimes they even feel pain with words because words feel intrusive. So we have to offer our communication in ways which are not intrusive to them. Yeah, not, because they might even close their ears and, you know, like this. And we have to also, the way we look at them should not be intrusive, but sometimes we even not look at them. Be giving space the way we interact and invite them to look, for example, in the same direction and play with gestures or play in the sand or just some, you know, there's of course many ways, but it's you with definitely as a father you have probably tried everything you can, but it's a very fine respect for an extremely sensitive being. And with that deep respect and love, you will probably find more and more ways to communicate. Yes, all the way back there. Yes. Oh, yeah. The question is, I repeat it for the recording, what we can do to support someone in the bardo, in the intermediate state, after leaving this body, before entering a next existence. So, there is a lot which we can do. It's one of the important activities, actually, of lamas, of teachers of the tradition, to continue accompanying practitioners after they have left this body. So I skip the part before leaving this body. We go directly. So say a short process of dying, you can say that after 10-20 minutes, the inner dissolution process has happened. And if it is a short period of losing consciousness or even being in luminosity, then already half an hour later, the person might be in the bardo, might be in the intermediate state. So rather quickly, much more quickly than many books say. This you have to know. It's not 3 days, definitely not. After 3 days, most everybody has come out of this phase of unconsciousness, but most of them within an hour already. So then, when the mind stream is on the other side, then usually the first thing that is needed to support them is to speak to them, and you might feel the contact, you might feel it. There is usually a reaction in our energy system when the contact is established. And you say, you know, now I cannot see and hear you anymore. You are what is called dead, but actually you are not dead, you are alive. Yeah, so we have to help them in their bewilderment of not knowing whether they have really passed beyond. So yes, you have passed beyond, but you're still alive. And then we start reminding them of, you know, in the following hours and days, and especially the ones like 6 or 8 hours have passed after having passed, and then they become much more present. And then we give them reminders of what was their purpose in life and what they wished for after death, where they want to go. For some general, in my culture where I come from, most people, they want to go into the light, into love, into openness. Yeah, and so it's not much more specific than that. Others who have been practitioners, they are more specific, they want to go into awakening. But for all of them, we give the instructions of what they can do with their mind, how they can meditate now, in order not to be caught by the appearances, which are like dreams becoming quicker over time. The longer they are gone, the quicker the activity of mind becomes again. And it's very important to remind practitioners to see through the illusory nature. So this will be one important part. And the other is very important that they formulate, that they make wishes or that they make prayers, that they direct their energy towards where they really want to go. So if it's, for example, in my case, very often I have to do with Christian practitioners, so I will remind them of their prayers and where they want to go. So we guide everyone according to their wishes. We don't never impose other wishes. Yeah. If we don't know, okay, we help them to go as much as possible into the four immeasurable qualities, which we have already enumerated several times, and to that measureless luminosity, grand luminosity of the mind, which in our tradition we call Amitabha, but it's just another name for that awakening into the grand luminosity. So actually, what I do is that when someone whom I take care of has died, then usually every day I try to have a meditation where I really invite that mind stream to come and be there, and I try to feel which instructions are necessary now. And we share meditation and I speak to them in their mind. Sometimes they answer and like this, yeah. I can sometimes feel, and after a while I don't feel anymore. Then it feels like I cannot, there's no more contact. And then we can still make dedication prayers for them. We support them by dedicating our positive energies, our meditation to them, and so on. We might make offerings in their name, but then the active guidance gradually fades away. So that would be a summary of what we can do. Okay. If you are interested, there is in our media library a text in three languages which I put together. It's called Death, Bardo, and Rebirth. And this text, Death, Bardo, and Rebirth, I put together when I was still a Buddhist monk. It gives an overview of the processes when dying, and you know, all the intermediate state until one is reborn. So it gives you an idea. It was at some time I was very, very interested, I was very much into that, and it's a little summary for the public of the most important instructions. Okay, you said already many questions. Back there. Oh, interesting question. I can speak from experience. So the question was, I repeat for the recording, if I could give some more advice or some more advices on how to reduce the clinging to a self in relationships, right? How to not to solidify the self in a relationship. Did I understand properly? Yeah. So, I have to find the point where I start. That's what I'm trying to think of. Already the complete willingness to communicate is an incredible step of non-self importance, because to block the communication or to cop out and to say, leave me alone, I meditate, or so, all of these self-defensive measures, they are allowed, but they should be limited. So if I say, I cannot speak now, then I should give a time, okay, but tomorrow we can speak, or give me a few hours, I will come back to you. Yeah, so the willingness to communicate is already the beginning of flexibility in our mind. We are not closing. So then, okay, how we communicate, the most important is that the communication comes from a place of truth, that we really speak from our heart, and this is also an act of selflessness to offer. It's a dana. Yeah, the whole relationship is a dana relationship. We offer ourselves, and the other person also offers. So we receive dana and we give dana. Yeah, generosity. So we offer the truthfulness of our feelings, of our words coming from the heart, our gestures coming from the heart. I have to make it short, of course, yeah? And then, since you are asking as a practitioner, I have talked yesterday about this wish for like a proof of our own existence through sensory contact. So partner relationship means also sensory contact in many ways, we need to bring in our meditation in the sensual contact also. So to learn to meditate while we have sexual relationship, to learn to meditate while caressing and while being caressed, to learn to meditate while we look into each other's eyes, while we listen to each other. All of this is sensory contact. And learning to meditate means that we go into this very spacious, fluent awareness, very finely listening while being aware of the empty nature of the listener as well as of the sound. So we are present, and at the same time we practice. And the best is, of course, if both do it. Yeah, that is beautiful. If both do it, and then you bring in the practice in all the areas where normally we react with clinging, with grasping, with solidifying, and exactly there we bring in our awareness. And if necessary, we talk with our partner about it. Because if it is one-sided, which is possible, you can do it only for yourself, even if the partner is not doing it. But the partner might sometimes be very surprised and even get angry that you are not clinging enough. Yeah? You're not getting jealous for this and that. Why are you not getting jealous, you know? You're not telling me to stay home. I want to be told to stay home if I go. No, you know, it's like, yeah, it's like, I want you to ask me. I want you to tell me that you miss me. You know, all of these, there can be so many mechanisms in a partnership which are solidifying. And sometimes we need to find good ways how much we appreciate the other person, but that we can live very well without the person. It would be in a normal relationship, it would be a slap in the face to say something like this. But it is so true. We have lived without the person before, and we can indeed live without that person, and even while we are in the relationship. So, but this deep respect for the feelings of the other person, and then to find the way of what is commitment in the relationship, and what is the, you know, commitment can be lived in freedom. It is not solidifying necessarily. Commitment is a commitment to being together and to this deep sharing and to not possessing each other, but sharing and helping and supporting each other. So commitment and freedom, love without grasping, and, you know, it's like there's a whole range of of experiences to explore and to bring our awareness to. Yes, I try to keep it short. Now, since everybody is interested, you can have one more question to go in more detail in one area of your question, if you have one, if something has been left unanswered. Yes, you. Yes. Is okay? Okay, good. Then? I said the other day that we cannot really help people. I did say that, yes. Yes. You know, I repeat for everybody, you know what kind of qualities you would like to bring and to offer as an inspiration to others. You think you are very far away. I to do exactly what you say. You know, I would love to give you my luminous presence, but right now I feel a little worried. You know, and that's your offering. That's inspiring. If you can say, yes, I have a motivation to give you something even better, but right now I feel like that. And don't make yourself smaller. Don't make yourself less. Just be true. And give that truth. And there is so much love in your being, so much, you know, wish to do well. And even if you feel incapable, then just to express that wish is already a fantastic offering. It touches everybody, you know, to hear, I wish I could help you, but I'm afraid myself. You are a bit confused of what you can do as a therapist when someone comes to you and wants to be guided and wants to be taken care of and going through the process. First thing is that you say, I can't help you. You have to do it yourself, but I can offer you support for doing it yourself. Okay, and I can offer you a field here. I can offer you an atmosphere in which we can explore. Okay, but all healing comes from what happens in the person itself. It never comes from the outside. So make that clear from the beginning. When people try to put the responsibility on you, I come to you, you know, I will come if you want twice a week, you know, but you have to make me happy. You say, sorry. That won't work. You say, no, that's not the contract. I take care of my own happiness, you take care of yours. Okay? That has to be clear from the beginning. Otherwise, it becomes an unclear relationship. Yeah, where we suddenly feel a responsibility for the well-being of others, which we can never fulfill. We cannot make a person happy, even if that person is right next to us. We can only inspire, and your clarity will inspire, your love will inspire, also your honesty of saying, I'm myself, I'm afraid, or I really don't know what to do. Let's see together where we can find some support. You know, all that is fantastic. And for me, because you were referring to if you are not like this guy, I'm just a normal person, you know. I'm just, I do like you, you know. I don't have to solve other people's problems. I don't know. I just offer them, you know, what I feel, my experience, whatever I can offer, I can share. And mostly, I feel like I'm holding a sphere of healing, yeah, a healing field. It's like an energetic field where I'm inviting awakened presence, you know, it's not even me. I just, you know, maybe the healing Buddha of the medicine Buddha is there, or maybe Tara is there. Or actually, I don't visualize much anymore. It's just happening by itself because I simply stay in the refuge. And that's basically what I'm doing. I simply stay in the refuge. And then there is a healing field. And then that seems to be the most important. And then there is a little bit of technique, of the way to talk, a little bit of experience. But basically, it's a very healing atmosphere in which we are through my own going for refuge. Yes, and whenever I don't know, then I don't know, then I pray more. I pray, I remember, yeah, as when I was a young lama, I prayed so much. Gendun, hey, what shall I do? What's helpful here? Gendun, my teacher's name, was the postal address for all my requests to the Buddhas. They all had the name Gendun, but I don't know who answered. But the mail was always answered immediately. Within a few seconds, the requests, something happens and the path continues. So prayer is what saves me. You don't know how often I've sat down here during this retreat and I didn't know what I was going to teach. Had no clue. Don't think I sit down here knowing what will happen. I have to feel. Fortunately, I do some prayers before, you know. I encourage all of you to do the same, so I have some time, you know. So that gives me space to feel. And then if I don't know what to do, I make everybody meditate. It's like that until it becomes clear. Yeah, just holding the space and praying myself. And so I hope this helps a little bit in response to your question. Please.
But also it can take a life of its own. For example, I was working with Tara, and I see her, and she's doing her own thing, and then she turns into a praying mantis, this big, scared bug. Yeah.
Well, she didn't turn, you turned her. So, good question. So, how to work with visualization? Actually, to be on the safe side, just follow the instructions. And refrain from all this innovative creativity that is usually simply the expression of our habitual tendencies. So when we work with visualizations, we should have deep respect that they come from visions of awakened practitioners. The origin of visualizations is not some therapist who made up a visualization that might help and often does help, but it is actually a gift received, which if we want to enter that dimension of awakening, we can tune in with that vision, which is now a visualization for us, because we are not having a vision right now. So we tune in. And it is a humble attitude of the mind to simply visualize, allow the visualization to arise as it was taught. And then, if you have difficulties with that, see someone experienced to talk about it. And then, of course, things can be adapted. But that is done not by your habitual tendency, but by someone experienced who has visualized a lot and knows what it is all about. So that would be a good way to deal with it. Yeah, you see, you are nodding, so seemingly that is okay as an answer. Yeah, okay. Because the example you said, I don't repeat it for the audio, but was a typical example of how a visualization by your own habitual tendency turns into something completely else. No? Definitely. Of course it was weird. Yeah, it was your own weird mind who made that. Not Tara, you know? And this is exactly, and then we have things which we enjoy, and then we dance around, and then actually we get lost. We get lost in our own habitual tendencies. Yes. How? A married monk. Doesn't work. First question answered, second question unnecessary. No, to be a married monk only exists in the Zen tradition. There's nowhere else where there are married monks, and this is due to the fact that the monastic community in Japan became too strong. And the emperor, one of the emperors, I of course don't know the name of Japan, made a decree that the monks have to marry. So they kept their bodhisattva vow, they kept certain rules of life, but they became householders. So then you have these married Zen monks, but no one else in the Buddhist tradition or also in other is called a monk and is being married. It just doesn't exist. I'm not a monk. And I'm not married. I have a wonderful partner. We are together since 7 years now, because before I was a monk. And the second quest, you have a second go. Mm-hmm. Whether the Mahamudra awakening is in one go or whether it goes progressively. And if it is a process for those who have sense in the eyes, then what would you recommend? So, awakening is always happening in the now. So it is always just now, and the experience is of that non-dual, timeless awareness that we call Bodhi or Dhammakaya. And that experience doesn't change from the first time when it arises until Buddhahood. It doesn't change. This experience doesn't change. But how long it stays, how often it appears, that changes. And that's the progress. It's like how much it is present in all different areas of our life. So in the beginning, it's an experience that shows and leaves a clarity, a certainty, and then it appears again and begins to transform our habitual tendencies. And now, very interesting for you. Nowadays, there are not so many practitioners that have this very clear first experience where they can say, that was the moment when I realized the nature of mind. So for many practitioners, what happens is that their shamatha practice, their practice of calm abiding, becomes clearer, always clearer, and the ground luminosity begins to shine through. And we compare this to the dawn before the sun rises. It becomes lighter. It becomes already, you begin to see things, you begin to understand the Four Noble Truths, you begin to, the understanding becomes always finer and finer, but not yet, it has not yet, the sun has not yet risen, but when the first ray of the sun crosses the horizon, that's the first moment of real awakening. And then you have seen the sun. Even if you haven't seen it completely, that is the first moment of real awakening. But all the time before, there's already a process of understanding better and better and getting an intuitive feeling for how it is. You begin to be seeing. And the seeing is not quite completely free of all veils, but nevertheless, it is a seeing. So I encourage you, and that's the advice to give, to enhance your practice of a calm, clear mind, looking at the nature of phenomena, looking at the nature of mind, practicing insight meditation in the frame of an undistracted mind. Yes? So that is how you get there. Okay. You still have to wait. Yeah, my dear, yeah. Yes. How to practice at home with all these different practices. I have to repeat for them back there. Mm-hmm. When I was talking about these undercurrents, this one, yes. That's a good thing. Yes, you are. Odeya's question is that yesterday when I was talking about the four outflows, the four undercurrents, then afterwards I was moving into the four immeasurables, these four Brahma Viharas. As she got the feeling, you got the feeling that the in the presence of the four Brahma Viharas, these four undercurrents are not nourished anymore, disappear, are dissolved. Now you are really putting the finger or our nose onto something really interesting. Really, really interesting. It is true what you say. It is true. Now, it is not like the four Brahma Viharas would connect to the four outflows, but actually, with love and compassion, there is that is a yes, a deep acceptance of what is and what happens, whether it is agreeable or disagreeable. Yes. And when love, compassion, when they develop, they become selfless. Yeah, they lose their center. It is a centerless love and compassion, and joy has an enormous dynamic of dissolving the sense of a me in the center. Yeah, and there's no question about existence and non-existence in there. And of course, when you go to the core of equanimity, what equanimity really is, then it is the deep understanding of the empty nature of all phenomena. And that's why one is equanimous. There is no grasping to the ungraspable. So that is wonderful to see. And this deep wisdom then that makes that there is no grasping to existence, to non-existence, to sensual contact, and so on, and no wanting to obscure the mind. But all of them together are a sure way to purify, if you take them really deeply. Yeah. If you take them really to the depths of their meaning, then they include the whole path to awakening.
So it can be valuable to sometimes stay with the undercurrents in order to have that precision, meet those
subtle grasping. It could. It could be valuable, I repeat what you're saying, it could be valuable to stay from time to time contemplating the presence of those undercurrents and to become aware of them. You don't need to stay very long, but to be aware that they might be influencing our relationship to the world and how we deal with ourselves and others and situations. And then you move on into the four immeasurables, for example. Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. Time for dinner. Let's dedicate. Remember, there is this prayer. Sunam de yitam jesim panin tobne ne pedranam pam jene kenga na chimpalam jumpaye si petso le jova jova shuk Jampe bhavajita kempadang kanto zampo de yande shinte de da kanji te so da lom jing ke vande da tam je rab tungu Sangye kusum ne pejin lam dan Chene minju dem pejin lam dan Gendun mi che dem pejin lam jin Chitang o waman lam dum pajun